Good afternoon. We call the House Finance Committee to order. It's almost consistent, 10:38 this time.
1:38.
Why am I thinking 10? Good grief. Anyway, time is corrected. Members present, Representative Jewell, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Fairclough, Co-Chair of Finance, Representative Stoltz, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgman, Representative Costello, Representative Newman, and Co-Chair Thomas. We have a quorum and we're ready to do business. Today we're going to hear from two departments, Military Veterans Affairs and Natural Resources. And so at this time I'd like to call Major General Thomas Katkus up, along with McHugh Pierre, make your presentation, and Susan Culligan. So with that, General, good afternoon, and thank you for helping in Cordova. Did you find enough shovels? The shovel ready now, of course, right?
So we've got the right kind of shovels, yes.
Yeah.
We have a Wasilla resident, a former Valley resident, and a Chugiak resident here. You probably can't put three better groups together.
Yeah. That's great consideration. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for having us here today to be able to talk about the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I appreciate the time that is allotted to us also. If time was allotted by the percentage of the budget, we would be here probably a brief commercial. If you look at our budget impacting the state, is less than 0.5%. But this is important in the GF area, where that funding really turns into a significant impact to the citizens of our state. What I'd like to do today is kind of follow on where I briefed last year. And I did a lot of talking last year and briefed the department. Today, we're going to, again, reiterate what our mission statement is, what our core responsibility to the citizens of Alaska are. And then what I'd like to do is present a video which kind of encapsulates what we did last year. And in a time of results-based budgeting, I think the video really says the money that was invested in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs was translated into a significant positive impact for the citizens of the state of Alaska. And in that venue, this video was put together by a young second lieutenant who is working for us, and with just a little tweaking, we took that positive image that he created on his own, and it demonstrates kind of the sense of pride and ownership that our young men and women in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs partake in the department. So as you see, some of us older guys sitting here and younger people, the department's really, really coming along fabulously. So with that, quickly go over our mission. Provide military forces. A lot of people think that they see Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, they see a person in uniform, it's our National Guard. Realizing that it is more than the National Guard, it is the response to any emergency in any one of our communities, in anywhere in the state, through our Homeland Security Division. The emergency response is one portion of it. We take care of the elder serving members of our military, the veterans, and we take them all the way to the establishment and working of cemeteries. And we start off with our youth, all the way back to the youth that are having some challenges in our traditional education processes, and we put them into the Alaska Military Youth Academy. And we've got a new addition with the technology that is present in today's society by bringing on aerospace. So again, overall, our mission encapsulates much, much more than military service. Our core services that we do, through the military uniform, we defend and protect Alaska and the United States. That's our military component. Through our emergency management process and the people working in emergency management, we prepare, respond to disasters. As clearly indicated, we are doing a great job in the preparation phase with the education and getting our communities ready for disasters. Our youth intervention continues on a very strong track, a very relevant method of addressing the youth that have no other means or options for them as a result of some poor choices that they've made in their life. And now, through our process, we've given them some options. And then, most importantly, and probably where you'll see later in my priorities, we're really, really trying to emphasize our outreach and getting a hold of the veterans that are out there, those men and women who have provided service to this nation and the state, and making sure that they are getting all of the earned benefits and all of the right integration back from war and back into our communities that they deserve. So with that, what I'd like to do, if we could dim the lights out, I would like to present this video. It's about 6 minutes long. What it does, it's kind of the tip of the iceberg of what the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs did in the year 2011.
Whether it's deploying to defend freedom overseas or being called for emergency response within Alaska's communities, this is the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Year in Review.
And in witnessing the ceremony, I should say you're also honoring all the dedicated Alaskans who have served our state and our nation by operating in and from this venerable campus.
The people of Alaska have to, if they don't realize what a wonderful asset they have, they should really appreciate the fact that a phone call away, they have absolutely the highest trained, most skilled rescue personnel on the planet.
I think it's great bringing attention, and you know, it's good for Alaska, it's good for the people, and it's good for the all around.
Probably something you've seen before if you were in Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, and we will be there for approximately 9 months.
Jason Collins, first sergeant,
team leader,
will now
case
you
out in
preparation for battle.
And you will be challenged, tested during this
deployment. We are going to protect the contractors that are going to be in the city, that are trying to rebuild schools and certain businesses. And we're going to provide security and clear up the town and city that we're going to.
More than the police,
you that you're a better person than what you were doing before.
The changes that get made in these young people's lives through the Austin Military Academy, those changes last for generations. It's not just their life that are impacting you, but it's the lives of everybody they come into contact with, including future generations. So, Austin Military Youth Academy is not just building young people, they're building Alaska's future.
There are three simple ways you can protect yourself. It's time to get ready, Alaska.
So we have a lot of state and federal agencies right in here that are helping us with the problem solving. Each bit of information we get from a community is now worked on, seeing what can we do, what is the best means of it. But we're also using all the liaisons from the state and federal agencies. How can we predict, how can we lay out a plan for anything that happens in the future?
Get this material into us. We've been having to wait for anything. Everything is coming. It's just invalid. But there's a lot of people behind that. And you know, Alaska, Homeland Security, they have played a tremendous part in this. And in order to get this project done in 7 weeks, that's what it's going to take.
But of course, NASA, others are paying much more attention to us as we go forward. We've had a strong partnership with Missile Defense. We hope to help grow that aerospace industry through direct Alaska aerospace jobs that we're attracting the aerospace companies into Alaska, so that Alaska not only has a war fighter, it has a supply chain, the logistics, and the support right here next to it to help benefit us as a nation, us as a state. And there's no reason we shouldn't have as strong an aerospace industry as we have military presence here.
Zero.
This is the time where Alaska can be a leader. As one of the few launch facilities in the country, at a time when our country needs space launch so critically, this is the time that we can go and make it happen. With that capability and the need for America to grow, and the willingness of the Alaska Department of the other states to take that message to Washington, I think the future is going to be good for Alaska. This is going to be good for the state in having jobs, employment, and diversity in our economy.
This job is one that you have to have a real team heart condition to do. You have to have a willingness to serve your fellow veterans, and presenting medals from those people that have been forgotten in the past is huge. The effects not only on the veteran, but also on the family, is an acknowledgement that we honor their service, is what it really comes down to. And with that acknowledgement is what has allowed us to move forward positively in our communities. It's hard to name 77,025 veterans, but our goal is to be able to put face with each one of those numbers.
You can certainly see why, as the leadership team of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, the people sitting at this table are very, very proud. And the young men and women, not only the men and women in uniform, but all of the folks that are here to make everything in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs work for us. To get the 30,000-foot overview today, the main emphasis there is we don't anticipate dropping away from any of our efforts that you saw in the video. And we're now going to have additive to that the priorities set for our emergency response. So as my first bullet, it's emergency food supply. When we had the disaster in Japan last year, there was a sense, and it kind of drifted away from our real threat of tsunami into the threat of radiation, and some folks brought up some issues with iodine. And we realized at that point we started talking national stockpile equivalent here in Alaska, a long ways from anywhere. How do we sustain ourselves for the first hours, days of an emergency, a true emergency where clearly last week when Seattle was shut down for a snowstorm, you saw no Alaska Airlines jets coming through Juneau. You saw no Alaska Airlines. It's going to be the same with the supply system if there is a catastrophe that interrupts that. So in addressing last year, water and energy, getting water purification and some type of power generation asset available in an emergency stockpile capacity, this year we're looking at food supplies. And our goal is to address, still very much in the planning phase, to roughly be able to feed about 40,000 people for a week. That is no small order, nor is there a pre-scripted plan on anybody's desk that says how to do that. So in emergency management, we have an expertise there for planners, and they are engaging on that very, very hard. Veteran service expansion. Right now we have less than two-thirds of our veterans registered for service and benefits here in Alaska. So out of 77,000, roughly a third of those are registered and are receiving the benefits that are due them. That is money into our economy, that is money into those households, that is addressing the health and welfare of those families. So our efforts to engage those folks who, using the principle of the military, which is selfless service, give it to somebody who needs something, I don't need it, trying to break that a little bit and realize there's a lot of individuals who justly deserve these benefits, and we're going to make every effort we can to get out, touch those people, and encourage them and get them to get in line, to get signed up for the dues, the benefits that they are, you know, absolutely have earned through their service. Alaska Aerospace Corporation, it's a new kid on the block. It is new technology. It's got potential. It's got opportunity. And it has a great facility as a component of it. Alaska Aerospace is much larger than just the Kodiak Launch Complex. But Kodiak Launch Complex has got a reputation in the aerospace industry as being very modern, very responsive, and fiscally the right tool out there. It's pretty lean and mean and is very, very capable. And with that, the opportunity to grow that in today's environment is significant, and we are going to be looking forward to make sure we maintain its relevancy and its capacity, but most importantly, the technology, which changes on a regular basis, but to stay up with what is required in today's environment to be competitive in that field.
In regards to that, how long do we expect to maintain that if it's not being used? Another year, 2 years?
I think I'd be remiss if I said how many years. Right now we've got some things, just like at the checklist, if things start to happen, they could happen very solidly. So there are interests out there that in today's environment, they're solidifying their position to make commitments. And with those commitments, I can better answer that. Representative Dugan asked me a question last year that said, when is it time to call that a day? And I told him, I will be the one to make that call. In the years since that question was asked of me, I've seen the interest and I've seen the potential, not just from my point of view, but some very significant professionals that do this for a living, real rocket scientists. This is a pretty good gem, and it doesn't turn around overnight. So I'm still in a position. I'll make that call, and you'll have to trust that the leadership is not going to lead us down a road on that.
Well, we're just looking at $28 million a year, so you haven't heard my spiel as in 2 years we'll be in a deficit and we're going to have to start cutting somewhere and looking at programs aren't successful, you know. So that's why I'm saying how many years. You know, I support the military. I'm a former vet, but there's a point where you don't retreat, but you give, you know, quit.
Absolutely agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, General.
Those are the three priorities. What I'd like to do is now cover just a few of the specifics and then leave room for questions as far as what the results are of last year's investment. So with that next slide, you can see that The 79 states in Alaska are some of our pilots, hunters, snow machiners, four-wheelers that have a real tendency to get in trouble, and we can apply some of these great resources that we've got in the uniformed services, primarily through the air and the Army National Guard. Those 25 saves in Afghanistan weren't the easy saves. Those were under direct fire. Those were in at least one situation that is consideration for the Silver Star for the participants of that. Significant engagement. They brought home no injuries, one minor injury, pardon me, but primarily because of their resiliency and training and responsiveness that they have because they train and work so hard in Alaska. It's a direct result. When the Alaskans came on the theater, they were seen as already subject matter experts. And going across here, the five state declared disasters, three of which were federal ones. We have the Youth Academy. We are meeting, and the real important one goes directly to our emphasis to try to get more veterans. 14,360 veteran claims and disabilities we work. That $43.7 million is a direct money that comes into our economy through the families that receive those benefits from our efforts to engage those veterans. Registered an increase of 5,000 last year. So we're looking proportionally, results-based budgeting. We will put a little more effort into that through resourcing and bring home even more than 5,000 again this next year.
Just a comment on that in regards being a veteran and watching, most don't want to accept or say that they have a problem. So you have to probably dig into the families, and that's hard to do, to tell them that my son is messed up or, you know, but people need to do that. And because I keep telling people I bury friends who never came back from Vietnam, and they've carried that scar for, probably one guy was there in 66, 65 when he was going in there, so, but they never left it. So, you know, we need to work with the families. Find out who they are.
Mr. Chairman, you're hitting on all cylinders of what we are very fortunate the U.S. military has said. This isn't Alaska in and of itself. The entire U.S. military sees this as a holistic approach. And what the side benefit of the emphasis, we are reaching back into veterans from prior conflicts and getting some of those folks, a lot of those folks, the same help as our current veterans. It's not segregated. So as it becomes more socially acceptable to acknowledge you have an issue, get the stigma away from it, and be able to treat it. That's the end state that the U.S. military is looking for today.
Thank you. Like I said, the hardest thing is for a man who is broken down, built up to be a stronger man, admits that he's now back where he was before he joined the military. Yeah, anyway, you know what I mean. Maybe that's what everybody else says, and I see another path breaking his head, but it's really hard to do. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. You can see our energy. We are going to put emphasis in addition to all the other stuff you saw. That's our priority this year. We're going to make a difference. And as you see, there are challenging, pressing issues. I pretty much hit upon emergency preparedness. You can never be totally prepared for the big emergency, the big problem. But at least you've got a plan and even a some type of semblance of a plan which somewhat addresses what the current issue is better than no plan. And we have been working hard. We're going to continue because now we've got so many moving pieces with Northern Command and all of the other states. The emphasis is the synergy of an approach to a problem. Nobody's independent out there, but it does start at the local level and getting the training out there, capitalizing on that training, and then expanding it and realizing those resources can be applied. The AMIA funding formula, that's really where we're not in sync with results-based. We have budget, and we have the results, and I think we can do better with less budget, better results. We can work that. So that's going to be one of our priorities to try to get that straight. And just like the questions from Representative Dugan and yourself, sir, Alaska Aerospace Corporation, put a full court press to make sure that we can clearly articulate what we're trying to do there and how we're going to do it, and hopefully we will give you a time frame of when we're going to do it also. With that, I'm open for any questions.
Representative Stoltz.
I have questions for Chair in three areas, but I'll just take one at a time and go around with you.
Well, you can ask all three. We're way ahead of ourselves today.
First question is on service officers. As you identify more people and make them aware of eligibility and use more services, is our current level going to be adequate with increased awareness? You know, just like the schools send out notes and tell every parent how to get their kids on every government program so you get more demand, I mean, as we get more awareness, as we've made a very concerted effort by changes in statutes, and what's your expectation on service officer ability to handle the workload?
Mr. Chairman, we took that into account, that as we get more publicity, more information out there, and educate those folks that deserve those benefits they've earned, that our request for additive resources in this respect would meet that demand. So I think we're in the ballpark. I would hope that we're actually under. The more veterans we have, we still have the capacity to surge, if at all possible. But I think we did a deliberate planning process to address that very issue.
Thank you. On preparedness, I talked to Mr. Pierre about an issue previously, and I'm a member of a lot of service organizations, and I just know government doesn't do anything cheap, and they don't do too many things efficiently. There's a lot of guidance, and your predecessor, General Campbell, actually was at the dedication of my Lions Club in Chugiak, bought a generator which would power a small village, and it's we donated it to the American Legion Hall in Peters Creek, which I know you're aware of that location, and we did it with the cost of getting the generator, and because it's a service organization and one of our members worked at NC Equipment, and we got a lot of considerations, things that government can't do. Procurement alone probably would have cost you $30,000. Trying to develop a plan on how to spend money. And I think there's so many opportunities, and we look at the cost of heating buildings in rural Alaska that belong to service clubs or community buildings. There might be a win-win situation. I just watching government operate, okay, let's go and plan to build a bunch of new buildings instead of, is there something that's vacant in Kotzebue that maybe a local nonprofit or maybe a native corporation owns or maybe a service club owns? There's got to be an opportunity in every single community almost. Cordova, I know your service area, they struggle to even just to pay taxes that they're charged. That's one of the issues I talked about. I'm really serious about this. If we do this right in new preparedness, if we go for the standard government plan and we start designing buildings and building a community, we'll get a couple of them built from what we could probably outfit the whole state if we actually work with our nonprofits, our service organizations, and utilize buildings that people might be having a trouble just even keeping the heat on in there. Since I talked to Mr. Pierre maybe a week ago and said, have you guys chewed that at all?
Yes, sir. It's called course of action development, and I've sent the planning team after course of action development to provide options. Preferably, we do have capacity within our National Guard armories or other facilities. We also have capacity within our workforce, our state defense force. There's subject matter experts that do this on a voluntary basis. Our own soldiers and in state active duty are a lot cheaper than hiring entire employees. The maintenance on some of these, if done correctly, we can maintain them very efficiently. Our concern is to make sure at the same time we've got good, easy, quick access to these facilities also. And that's where if we keep it as best we can within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, amongst either our Guards members and our Guard facilities, we've got access through aviation assets or other methods to quickly bring that resource to the problem without an extra loss of time and energy in trying to pre-coordinate or coordinate with other entities.
We'll follow up on this. Not every community has an armory or a National Guard facility either. Chairman, the last question is on flooding in interior Alaska and other parts of the state. I'm asking this solely at the request. I met with a constituent right before I came here. He does strategic blasting and perforating. I know he's done it on a creek not by where both you and I live, and he's done it in other areas of the state. He said on the last big flooding problem, was it Cripple Creek, I think? He said he had approached somebody. He couldn't remember the name. It sounded like it might have been Mr. O'Hare that he approached. As he described him, a director. And it was just, he made the suggestion, hey, would you guys investigate this as a possibility? He said, too much liability. I don't know, was that issue vetted? The whole blasting, and I don't want to just take it that I just wanted to, I promised him I would follow up on this issue, and I said, I bet you I'd be seeing you soon, and here we are.
So I'm no expert on some of the things, but I know that question has come up because the first question is, why can't we get the Air Force to bomb it? you know, again, using high explosives to move the ice. And the response on that is you'll move it quicker, faster downriver where it'll jam again and cause even a greater problem. So mitigating it, you mitigate it over time in letting usually nature work its way through there and being responsive to try to get above the high water marks, build your communities higher, or respond. But where we get out there in this respect, we provide education before the ice starts to go out through the Riverwatch program. We fly and provide resources to get community leaders up in the air to look at the ice. They're the subject matter experts, and they can pretty much predict what is happening. And pretty rarely do we get surprised where we can't get in there and actually do the right necessary means to address the issue. But again, if you use explosives, it's sudden, it's violent, and all of a sudden somebody else may have an unpredictable problem further down the river.
So am I to interpret that you analyzed the proposal, embedded it, and determined it?
It's not the best course of action, sir.
Okay. Those are all I had.
Other questions? The other day we met with Mr. Pierre and told us that the VSO office was moving over to the Veterans Clinic. And I asked him if he was going to Olive Garden. But anyway, just add to it, then people can, eat and greet. But I think just moving that to the near the clinic, you're going to have an increase of veterans coming over there.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question, if I could squeeze in a question about rural armories and maybe an opportunity to give a brief update on how things have gone the past year. Are there any new armories that have been put in place? You and I met a couple years ago in Dillingham, for example, and I sure appreciate your support on rural armories, but maybe an opportunity to just a quick update.
One of the largest rural armories that just had a dedication several months ago was Bethel Armory. That is in place. It's a beautiful facility out there. We did manage to get it located very much in a better position strategically in today's environment out next to the aviation facility on the Bethel Airport. So you've got a very nice facility. The unit that lives there is currently in Atterbury getting ready in its final training to go to Afghanistan, a little over 100 folks there. So not only has the armory been built, it is effectively supporting one of our federal responses out. We also, again, speaking back to courses of action, we're assessing those locations where we've got two or three buildings. That's excess capacity. And is that excess capacity better spent by giving it or divesting it to the communities? So you'll be seeing us approach the communities and see what resources we have that they can better utilize. Tuxedo Bay is a perfect example where they have a post office about the size of this desk, and at Christmas time, their packages are out in the street where we've got a building out there that would serve easily as a post office, and we can divest it through legal processes and give it to the community. So we'll be looking across the state at all of our armories, and where it doesn't impact our wartime mission or our state mission, we will be looking for those communities that could put a resource like that to good use.
If I might add, Mr. Chairman, for the record, the QPR Deputy Commissioner, through the Chair, Representative Edgman, there are two locations that we're looking at for possible relocation of those armories in the courses of action. The Delta Junction area, Dillingham, those are two communities that we see a growth and an interest of folks to join the National Guard. And you might say, well, why would you need it at Fort Greeley's right next to Delta Junction? But they can't do the traditional drill status activities on Fort Greeley because it's not sanctioned for that. It is an active duty facility that our folks do live on and work on. But to do a traditional guard member's job, you have to do it at an armory at a different drill location. So that's why when we're looking at all of the buildings that we have, 400-plus buildings in 77 communities across the state, we're looking to see how much it would cost to move some of those buildings to get them in locations that will be better served by our members.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edgman, one final very successful story is working with Commissioner Masters with the Department of Public Safety. Both Selawik and Emonic, the armories there are now containing troopers, and that gives us a toehold there with law enforcement and also gives us an insight into the community as to how to target and look for those people who are qualified to get into the National Guard as we start to try to build up our National Guard presence in the rural communities through partnerships.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. on vet services, sometimes really good things can come out of bad experiences. I think sometimes those
those bad experiences pave the way for the kinds of support that we're seeing for our vets coming out of these conflicts. And I'm referring to the Vietnam vets. You guys broke some ground, and good things are happening as a result of it today in terms of our ability to be more supportive of our troops in a quicker period of time. With regards to vet services, and particularly with the Alaska Native people who serve, is there a coordination between them as IHS vets? Actually, it probably wouldn't apply just to the Native people, but vets in general, because it's kind of like they're both coming out of a federal pot, right? But is there coordination in terms of what the vets provide and what IHS can provide so that people can maximize and getting that information to them so that they know that while IHS might not be able to do so much for hearing, they might be able to get it at the vet side, or if the dentistry can't help you on the vet side, they can get it at IHS. Is that kind of thing going on?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, if I can, I'm going to let my deputy answer some of that, but I want to hit on this is because I was specifically out in Bethel last week with Dave McIntyre, who is in charge of Tri-West, and they signed an agreement with the healthcare services out in the Bethel area to treat our military veterans that are out there. So, yes, it's a very strong effort right now to make sure that the healthcare services we have in Alaska are applied locally. So to cut down travel, be more responsive, it's all of those issues. I thought it was phenomenal. They took on that task a year ago when they realized that we had a unit deploying out of Bethel. And the advice that was provided to them was, get out there and do it right, because Alaska is the largest small community in America. And if you do it wrong, you'll know it. If you do it right, they'll know it also. And so far, Tri-West has done a phenomenal job in working with them.
Yep. And if I might add, through the chair, for the record, McHugh Pierre, through the chair, Representative Jewell, those local providers are the IHS staff. And now that the VA reimburses IHS and BIA health efforts, the same people know both sides. And when they talk to a person they're serving, they're saying, hey, this is the best course of action for you. And they have that individual recognition of how to best serve that patient. So we've seen certainly a better service level. We're hoping to make it better by also increasing our visits to the rural areas with the health experts from the VA, our veteran service officers, and other family counselors.
Okay, and then just one more comment on the preparedness side of what you do based on some more recent past where you've had to be reactive with the events that came this fall with the great big storm. It was kind of neat to see people being proactive in terms of preparedness and probably in terms of savings and also just people awareness. So good job.
Thank you, Representative.
Questions? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can't this opportunity to go by without thanking the department and Mr. Pierre and all the work that they've been doing to coordinate a location and a site and the development of the Veterans Cemetery that's being planned at Fairbanks. There was quite a significant meeting in the mayor's office. Well, it was a while back, but it was between the mayor and Commissioner Sullivan's people as well. I mean, I thought it was everybody did a great job, and now we're focusing on one place. But I can't let the opportunity go by without thanking you and the commissioner's people at the Division of Lands and such. Thank you.
Representative, thank you.
Just a final comment, and he let you go. I have a Captain Schroeder in my office that tried to transfer him to Haines to reopen the guard unit there. He refused. So, but he is trying to get into your guard unit again, so, or into your unit. He's, you know his history. He's the Veterans Caucus liaison, so two tours in Iraq, and he won't go to Haines, so just a little safer there, but he didn't want to go, so thank you, General. Thank you. Oh, Mrs. Stoltz.
Just on the first second item I brought up, and that was on the blasting, I just was going through the packet that the fellow from North gave me, and he had a letter in here from a DOT regional manager, and just recommending all the other DOT guys to do river. I just wonder how much it bent. Like I said, I know there's issues with it, but it's sometimes doing something different. Like I said, I know they did it on Peters Creek, right where you and I live. But it's it does work in some places. It's if it stops a flooding project. And I know there's always concerns about what happens downriver, but just want to make sure it just wasn't summarily rejected, because you use a lot of pejoratives, dropping bomb. So it's just sometimes, the military doesn't change their ways real easily either. I'm not advocating one. I just want to make sure there actually is an honest look at it.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just follow up on that.
Yeah.
We really do take input from the locals. Those folks know their river. And if they said, hey, this is the spot that we might do something, we would probably, that might be the end state that we decide on. So nothing's ever off the table in trying to solve a solution. But most of the local folks know how to handle their issues out there. So we take that into a lot of consideration.
Mr. Chairman, can I do one other plug?
Plug.
I was real surprised that we got approached by the Veterans Administration. They don't buy coffee for the veterans waiting there, and it's which kind of surprised me. That's a pretty basic thing, but you got to pay for those $500 toilets somewhere. But I was surprised. When the last Lions Club meeting, I was at home. It was a real easy vote to pass. It was like $300 a month, so we voted to do that. I think they do it by thirds, not quarters, and it's for $1,200. Our club paid for coffee. That takes care of 4 months. Well, that's a real cheap price to pay to help out, and it's an opportunity to. I was just real surprised that they couldn't provide coffee for places where you historically wait a long time, and they develop those addictions often in the military. So that's just a pitch. It's not a big amount of money. I belong to numerous service clubs, and there's a lot of others. That's an outfit in Anchorage, but it was an easy thing to do. And maybe somebody else will listen, and listen in will help pay for a few more months.
That, Mr. Chair, if I can have one last closing comment, my own pitch, and that is everyone never be shy approaching any one of our military members in uniform and grabbing their hand and giving them a very solid shake and a thank you for their service. Acknowledge their service. Those young men and women, that's better than a paycheck. It surprises them, and it really sends a message. So thank you for having us here today.
Thank you. We'll take a five-minute break and switch commissioners. Okay, we're back. At this time, we're going to have Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan. I'll turn the mic over to you and introduce your staff and your backup in the audience.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Dan Sullivan. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. With me in the room, on my left, is Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles. On my right is the Director of Support Services, Gene Davis. I also have Joe Balash, the Deputy Commissioner, Kathleen Rowell, who's assistant, Esther Temple, the legislative liaison, Dennis Giardo and Becky Nelson also here in the room who work with Gene. And I believe on the line, Wynn Minifree and Marty Parsons from the two deputies from the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. So it's a pleasure to be here. What I wanted to do this afternoon is first to reiterate what I've been mentioning in other opportunities to testify, and that's a priority, top priority for DNR is to have a strong, respectful, and responsive relationship with the legislature, and we certainly hope to continue that. We've had a lot of directors all over Juneau the last couple weeks, and I want to mention directly to all of you, if you don't feel you're getting that, you know, responsiveness or respect from me or any of my team, I would welcome you to let me know, and we'll fix that. I also want to mention just the overview. I have a number of slides, but I plan on going through those quite quickly. But to give just an update on essentially what we've been working on since the last legislative session, particularly laying out some of the strategies, activities, and results from the past year, which we saw as a promising year, and then looking at highlighting key aspects of the FY13 budget proposals as a way to build on those, what we saw as some of the accomplishments from 2011. So I'll just go right into the presentation here. As I mentioned, a quick DNR overview, and I will walk through that quickly. And the look back, the core of this is looking at the what we saw as a promising 2011, some of the significant challenges that I know this committee is very up to speed on, and then some budget highlights for FY13. So just in terms of the overview, we did over the course of last year work hard on, we actually revamped our mission statement and then the four core services, particularly on the core services to what we thought was a better reflection of actually what the division overall and all the, or what the agency and all the different divisions do. And I'd be glad to discuss this or take any questions on that. There's been a number of questions on the mission statement lately. I'd be glad to go into those if any of the committee members have questions.
Of course, I'm getting feedback on this from my district. And I talked to Deputy Commissioner Fogle about this a moment ago, but, you know, a mission statement, as I know it, is essentially a bumper sticker. It's a slogan. It's a statement of symbolic meaning, so on and so forth. But I've had this brought to my attention that this, in fact, is under the legislative purview under Title 37. I'm not trying to create a stink about it, but maybe give you an opportunity to talk through it a little bit and explain to us what it means and why the changes were made and what the future plans of action are going to be, if any.
Through the chair, Representative Edmund. So the most important reason was that I thought it was important to have the mission statement align with the directive and the Constitution of what the policy of the state is. And to me, as the former Attorney General, and I thought that was an important change. And so I will tell you, when I testified last week, I was actually unaware of the statute that you're referring to. So since that time, I checked with the Department of Law, and what they said was it is indeed in the statute you mentioned the prerogative under statute of the legislature to set the missions. But they said if that hasn't happened or hasn't happened in a while, that it's also okay from the perspective of the commissioners to do what we did. So we would welcome legislative input here. The other reason, and I will tell you this, as you mentioned, in some ways it's a bumper sticker, but it's also important for an agency and the professionals in the agency, and we have a great group a great group of professionals in DNR. But I will tell you that one kind of surprising thing that I got feedback on from a number of communities when I was initially selected to be commissioner and went out to a bunch of different communities just to essentially hear from communities, hear what their concerns were, hear what their concerns about DNR were, good and bad, was that there was a sense that in some ways, with regard to land, that we viewed that as our land, right? It was DNR land. And if Alaskans wanted to use it, well, no, maybe not, maybe future Alaskans, but it wasn't for them. And I'm trying, I don't say that that's everywhere, but certainly in a number of communities, they felt that that was a theme. And I don't think that's the proper way that we should be engaging with Alaskan citizens. So there was also an element of management in the mission change. But I will tell you, I got the question last week. I got the question from a number of media reporters. You know, does this mean that we're not focused on conservation or future generations? Absolutely not. I mean, responsibly developed in the public interest, we think, encompasses conservation. We think it clearly encompasses thinking through the importance of development for future generations. And, I mean, we have whole divisions in DNR that focus on conservation, like parks and recreation, and those guys are doing a great job. So, to be honest, it was a little bit, it's kind of become a bigger issue than I had anticipated, but we would welcome the input from the legislature, and I just, on the statute that you mentioned, I was unaware of, and I don't think the legislature has made mission statements for agencies since 2003, I believe, was the last time.
Thank you.
I'm not. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And I've heard a couple comments about it as well. You know, and some of them, like Representative Edgman, just whose job is this? I mean, you know, what's going on with changing things? You know, this committee is making an effort this year more than in the past to do missions and measures and performance-based more than it has in a long time. But every year, missions and measures is on the table, and we've looked at them, and we've tried to tinker with them or not tinker with them to various success. And I'm concerned that advice from the Department of Law that says if the legislature hasn't touched them in a while, feel free. That seems to be pretty erroneous. I mean, maybe you misspoke. I don't know, but that sounded like what you said.
Well, I guess what I can do through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't think if I said feel free, I think I probably misspoke. Maybe what I can do is just give you the kind of directive. Because when I found out it was Representative Seaton that mentioned the statute, I wasn't aware of it. So I said, well, geez, let me go back and check. And so I did, and I got a response that, I think that would be an overstatement saying feel free. What I'd be glad to do is just give you the guidance that I've got. From our perspective, it's clear that it's a legislative prerogative, and I'm not trying to make work for anybody or jump into a controversy with regard to the mission of DNR. I do think that there's something to be said for aligning the mission of the agency most responsible for managing resource development in the state with the directive of the delegates in the Constitution. As many of you know, Article 8, Section 1 is a pretty unique provision as constitutional provisions go throughout the United States. There are not many states that actually lay out the main policy directive of the state in the Constitution, and that was really the driving force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then the core services, I do think that's actually a much better reflection of what we do and where our focus is than what we had previously, and it covers a lot more of the divisions than essentially just the resource development side. There's a lot more to DNR, as this committee knows, than resource development issues. Mr. Chairman, I'll go through these slides. I think you've seen most of these. It just gives a sense of the layout of the state and the very large, not only land that we manage, but also estimated resources. These numbers this committee has seen before with regard to hydrocarbons. I will say since the last time we've met and since the last legislative session, the U.S. Geological Survey came out in June with new estimates on Cook Inlet, and those numbers are reflected in the slide, and they're actually quite significant. If Cook Inlet were next to its big brother, younger but big brother, the North Slope, those would be very, very big numbers in most basins. These are numbers also that just kind of estimates on what we believe, again, USGS and other estimates on what the state has with regard to minerals and how we would rank if we were an independent country. Again, pretty impressive numbers. So what I wanted to do here, and again, I'll be very quick because I did this last year, but if there are any questions, certainly would want to entertain them. Just touching on the different divisions that DNR has and a little sense of the number of employees, the percent of our operating budget. Some of these, all of these are pretty straightforward. I think with the exception of maybe some of the interior delegation members, the second one I think surprises people a lot. That's almost, Division of Forestry is almost 30% of our operating budget.
Mr. Chair. Before you go farther, if you can go back to the previous page, somewhere along the line, are we going to see some efforts that the governor's making to increase activity in the rare earth elements categories?
Through the chair, Representative Enberg, we're there.
Okay, good.
Governor, it's in the I'll get to it.
Okay,
slide.
Thank you.
We had a great summit, actually, in
fair.
Knockout.
I think he did more shells.
Oh, sorry. No, governors, governor, we are all very focused on rare earths. So, again, forestry there, pretty big number, actually, but that's in large part because of horse fighting activities. Again, Mr. Chairman, I'll go through these pretty quickly unless there's any questions.
Commissioner, can we go back to forestry? Can you just give us a 30-second blast on this proposed who's hitting the forest? I've been hearing a lot from my part of the world about that. Is that a bill that that you're supporting?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair. For the record, my name is Ed Fogles. I'm the deputy commissioner, one of two deputy commissioners of the Department of Natural Resources, and it's part of my portfolio in the department. I'm over the Division of Forestry. The Susitna State Forest was a proposal that was laid out in the recently adopted Susitna Area Plan, which is the DNR land management plan for the Susitna area, and it recommended that certain lands within the Susitna area be legislatively designated as a state forest. These lands are where all the commercially valuable timber is located within the forest, as identified by our experts, and it's a legislative designation that that will enable the Division of Forestry to better manage our forest lands for commercial and other timber or forest activities.
I'm assuming, you know, I'd ask it, so I'm assuming you're claiming parentage of this child.
Well, the Representative Stoltz to the chair, the initial recommendation for the
yes or no is going to be fine on this.
Yes, it is in our DNR area plan as a recommendation.
And Mr. Chairman, it builds on, and we have a slide here that kind of talks about what we worked on in forestry, actually, with the legislature. We thought it was an important result from last year's legislature on expanding state forests for management, in part because we've had, particularly in this part of Alaska, problems with access to federal lands and the ensuing significant loss of forest timber-related jobs in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Fogles, let me ask you just on the Susitna Forest, and I haven't seen the boundaries of the map, but in that in the Susitna area, we have some of the most important salmon and trout streams to people who can't get off the road system and get out to Bristol Bay and other remote parts of the state. The Forestry Act allows some a broad range of no logging setbacks along streams, but some of them are pretty narrow. So do you have a view for us on how wide the, at least on the important streams, the no logging setbacks are going to be, so we don't have to worry about muddied up streams that shouldn't be muddied up?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I'm not going to be able to speak to the exact distance for those buffers. I don't have that number in my head, but I can get back to you on that. I do know that those buffers are prescribed by the state's Forest Practices Act, and there is discretion with the director of the division to adjust those depending on the need. Before that forest, if the forest does come into being, then there will be a requirement for a management plan where we'll go through and hone down the management and perhaps identify those more important areas, and that will have public input so that during that process we'll be able to identify areas where fish habitat is more important and might need extra protection.
Sorry, excuse me, through the chair. So we have to pass the bill before we find out whether the setbacks are broad enough?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, at a minimum, the setbacks would comply with the state's Forest Practices Act, and we can get those exact setbacks to you.
Thanks. Finally, through the chair. Some of those setbacks, the minimum setbacks, aren't very broad. They range between, 67 feet and 100-something feet. And I know the commissioner has the discretion to say, if it's an important stream, it's broader, right? But I'm not comforted by the minimum setbacks for the more important streams in that area. So I guess if the department can assure me that for the more important streams, the setbacks will be greater, I'd like to know that.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just continue going pretty quickly through the different divisions. I will mention one thing that we have been, since again the last legislative session, we've really put together, I would say, a very strong team here at DNR. The directors all come with a lot of leadership experience, a lot of private sector experience, public sector, so I think it's from my perspective, it's one of the most important accomplishments. I think when I testified the other day in front of House Resources, I probably spent 30 minutes going through the resume of each of these directors, and I can assure you that they're great public servants, work really hard, very good ideas, and committed to moving forward in the best interest of the state. So these are just more of the directors. That's our attempt at humor. See, it hasn't really gone over very well. That's genius. That's not genius. We're going to put her face there. But I don't know. Not really good. The pipeline office is actually, there's a lot of, and I'll get to it, but a fair amount of work there that they've done over the last year that's actually quite important. OPUMP, that's our, we've had some issues on permitting. We're trying to address some of those, a lot of them, but I can tell you that this group gets very high marks from almost anyone. This is the kind of state coordinating effort with regard to permitting on projects, and they do outstanding work. And then a lot of people are surprised, but the relationship between the DNR and the Mental Health Trust Authority, they have a very important job that they carry out in terms of their trust authority to their members.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you made any headway on your backlog of permits, applications?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, yes. So I have some slides here, I think, probably. I can go into more detail and get those slides.
Okay. Just that you're remiss. I think I've talked about the mental health trusts and our opportunities there just about every chance I get, since you have a slide. I just appreciate the collaborative relationship that DNR has. We've got a pretty good crew over there too. That's fulfilling their mission. That was set up by decades of clawing through the courts and not fully reconstituting it, but development and proceeds from leases and rentals. If we tie their hands, we're tying the hands of of funding the beneficiaries of the trust. And look at that board on there. There's people on there I trust in the trust. I see people like Mary Jane Michael, Jeff Jesse is the director, Dr. Doolittle out of Fairbanks. There's been some recriminations against them that they're carrying. A trust responsibility isn't just for the beneficiaries, but they have that land is their asset, and to suggest that they're not going to be excellent stewards, I think is I think really ignores what a trust is, especially with the legal and moral responsibilities that our mental health trust has.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, and I would agree with what you say there, and kind of the aligned interests that we often have with them on some of these big issues. So the kind of the meat of what I wanted to really talk about this afternoon was some of the activities, state strategies, and how we think they're starting in different areas of the resource development sector of the economy to bear fruit, and remind this committee that, you know, even though those are long lead times on some of these, that these are also future revenues that I know that the committee is interested in. So, reflecting what the governor talked about in the state of the state, this has been our principal focus, which is the TAP's throughput decline, which I think everybody recognizes is a very critical issue facing the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vidrin.
On this slide, I've had the privilege of being on this committee for a year and a half now, close to a year and a half. And if I didn't have an understanding, I certainly have a great understanding now that we're not going to cut our way out of our future budget crises that the state will be experiencing. I think that's a pretty factual statement. On the other hand, on the revenue side, I'm also convinced that the governor's number one priority of increasing throughput has to be the legislature's number one priority. I think there's some disagreements about the particular vehicle to get there. But I wonder, because I hear it in my district, and I wonder if others perhaps hear it in their districts as well, that the message in terms of getting out to the public at large here in Alaska about the critical nature of that issue, I wonder if it's sinking in, number one, and number two, to harken back to your comments last year when you said, this isn't about big oil. I really appreciate it, just being so bold and direct with those comments. Because I hear it a lot of times in my district, why would we give those fat cat oil companies a big tax break when they're making record profits off of our backs as owners of the resource up there? That statement goes back a number of years through a lot of past actions that none of us around the table here are responsible for. I wonder if you were to take an opinion poll across the state, do Alaskans understand the issue? Would they support taking such drastic measures? Again, not pointing a finger at whatever bill it might be, but have we effectively made our case? Because I hear in my district that we haven't, and maybe I'm isolated, I'm a remote rural district, but I still wonder, have we made our true matter case with Alaska public?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I think, in some ways, you might be talking on, at least from the way I hear it, kind of two different planes. I think that making the case that TAP's throughput is not a critical issue, I hope we're making the case, because I think it's a very strong case and very important case to make, whether you live in a rural area or in the Beltway or any part of the state. And one of the things on these slides that we think we made progress on is also trying to make the case in Washington that this is a critical issue not only for the state of Alaska, but for the national security and energy security interests of the United States. And I think we're making some headway in that area. But we're trying literally every day to make the case on the continued serious decline of our main source of government revenue, but also one of our biggest drivers of economic activity, is an enormously urgent and critical issue. And this is all the more striking to us when almost every other hydrocarbon basin in the United States and the rest of the world right now is booming, but with the exception of ours. And so, you know, one of the things I've testified in front of this committee on is kind of the threshold issue here, which is, hey, look, if we don't have the oil anymore and there's a decline, okay, well, I guess we can live with that. That's kind of inevitable. But it's not inevitable. We don't think it's inevitable at all. The professionals at DNR think that we have an enormous, I mean, those numbers that I just went through a couple slides ago, those are world-class numbers, world-class. And so we still have the capacity. This doesn't have to be the destiny of the state. And what we're trying to do is work through policies, and I'll get to some. Of course, the tax reform is a cornerstone of this front center, but one of the things I want to emphasize is we've been hitting on all kinds of other cylinders, not just that issue, over the course of the last year. And it's what one of the things, it's certainly the thing that we've been focused on the most at DNR.
Can I just follow up with a closing comment that, you know, with where I sit and how privy I am to have this sort of front row seat to this whole issue, understand it's certainly a whole lot more than, you know, anybody, any sort of layperson in my district. I feel like I've done my part in terms of elevating this issue awareness-wise in the Bristol Bay region, the Aleutian region, you know, my district as a whole. But I'm concerned that the administration hasn't, at least in my district, this is a pretty parochial statement here, that the administration hasn't gone out and made the case in a way that if I had to support a controversial measure, that I'm out there on my own, because there's some pretty hard and fast feelings about the oil industry. We all know, you know, whether or not they're true, whether they're based in, just sort of this mythic understanding of what's really taking place. I just have to sit here and wonder if we haven't really made the case in all corners of the state. And I understand you're trying. It's a critical situation. But, you know, if we were to take a poll of all Alaskans right now, 100% would say absolutely not. Lower the taxes on the oil industry. So I'll close by saying, in my senses, we have more work to do in that realm, and that's what I'm picking up in my district.
Through the chair, Representative Edgen, I would welcome the chance to come out and try and make the case. We've gone to a number of different areas, but I think, you know, we can always do a better job. And so getting out, I'll repeat what, you know, we talked about last year, is that from our perspective, the tax reform proposal has nothing to do with trying to increase profits. We think it's in the state's interest because we think it will lead to increased production, and that's the key. I don't care how much those companies make. That's not part of my job. Our job is to try and increase our production in the state, and one of the things that I've learned, and I can talk about it, is going around meeting with these other companies, meeting with companies that aren't here and that we're trying to get to invest in the state. They raise the issue. They raise the tax issue about, whether or not they want to come up to Alaska. They all know we have a great basin, but the costs that we have in the state, it's not just, there's certain costs that we control. Alaska is a very high-cost place to look and produce for oil, and a lot of those costs are going to be with us no matter what.
It is a tough issue. We've been subjected to a lot of the public relations on that. 150,000 barrels a day is, it's an acceptable level and things will be fine. But I think more people would want to be on communal regional affairs than on finance if we were at 150,000 barrels right now. We would be in such dire straits. But Representative Vera, then Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the public doesn't like is what's going on in Congress, where two groups have different ideas, so nothing gets done. It's obvious to folks that the Senate, the House, and the Governor, and various members of the legislature have different ideas. And I would just ask that you, I can't make you do this, but I ask that if you hear good ideas that aren't the same as the Governor's bill, that you analyze and remain open to them so something can happen. Because I think there is one thing that we all agree in, and that's that we would like to reverse the decline of throughput in the pipeline. It's crucial to the state. With that, you mentioned there are other ways to address the oil decline, and I'm curious as to the status of the lease terms that we now use when we lease land for the production of oil. You know, in Norway, if you don't produce after a certain amount, they either take your lease back or they explore and they charge you for the exploration. I can't imagine we're going to go that far here. But how tightly are the leases written so that if a company is not acting on a lease, we can take it back and rebid it? There was some movement in your department over the last few years to tighten that language, and I just don't know what the new leases say these days.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I agree with your comment. There's a, I think the focus where the governor, House, Senate are trying to get to is a agreement on tax reform. I would also say, though, and I could bore you guys to death, I won't, but there's a lot of elements of this strategy that, you know, the first part of the strategy is focused on tax reform, which we see as the cornerstone. But there's a number of elements of this strategy that I think would get very, very, very broad support across the board that we're trying to do. So I just want to note that, because there's a lot in here that I don't think is controversial at all. But with regard to leases, you know, I think, and this goes to Representative Edgman's, you know, this past year we've taken a number of actions that look to more quickly accelerate development on state land. And I can give you a few examples. We rejected unit applications that came in the door that we didn't think had a sufficient enough commitment to produce. We didn't unitize leases. Some companies came in with wanting to unitize whole areas of the state, and we just said, no, because we don't see commercial quantities. You haven't done enough exploration. We're not going to. So we took pretty strong actions, very focused on accelerating lease development. Cook Inlet, in the lease terms we had, the Cosmopolitan unit, I don't know if you think I talked about those lease terms. It had a commitment baked in because we knew that was an area that actually had oil. We knew it. So we had very aggressive lease terms that a big company actually did pick up. And then on our new North Slope lease terms themselves, for this last December lease sale, we increased what we thought was a rental rate that hadn't been changed in since statehood, I think. But more importantly, towards the end, we kept the 10-year term, which is pretty long, but we experimented with 5 and 7 years. But, you know, because the work is so difficult on the North Slope, we thought a 10-year term was appropriate. But the last 3 years of that term, the rental rates go significantly up. And the whole idea there is they go significantly up if you haven't drilled a well. And the whole idea there is drill or pay a very high rental rate or give the lease back. So we think those are four actions that go exactly with what you're talking about, of trying to accelerate production in a whole bunch of different ways.
Okay, we're going to go on with the presentation now. You could go on with the colloquy for quite a while.
So this is the strategy, and I can go into any part of this. It's a little short, but I can guarantee to this committee that this is one of the things that we've been very focused on. So we think we're starting to see some of this bearing some fruit. We're looking to have a strong exploration season this winter on the North Slope, if you include the winter season and going into the spring. Right now we're looking at the possibility of about 20 exploration wells, so a pretty good number there. We had what we thought was a strong lease sale. One of the elements of that strategy was actually get out, talk to companies, talk to investors, and I can tell you we did that very, very aggressively over the course of the last year. And what was a little surprising was certain companies who we thought were going to bid and come to our lease sale actually didn't at the end. So we're kind of following up, asking why. We had some who just said, no, we're not interested until you change your cost structure. But we did have, you know, as I mentioned, see that third bullet there, some world-class companies, Shell, Conoco, Repsol, thinking out more state acreage, which we think is quite important. Another good positive result, and I think this is, you know, a lot of the legislature's policies that were enacted, that we're starting to see a lot of activity in Cook Inlet, which I think a year and a half ago most people would not have predicted. As I mentioned, the USGS came out with some pretty pretty big numbers there on their latest estimates. Look at that 19 trillion cubic feet of gas. And importantly, we had a very strong lease sale, probably one of our best lease sales in 30 years. From our perspective, working with, talking with these companies, the tax incentives and very, very aggressive investment in tax incentives in Cook Inlet are one of the key things driving this crisis. I did have the opportunity to go out again as part of our strategy, brief some of the CEOs of the companies that showed up here, walked them through the lease terms, really encouraged them to come. And so we had a good turnout, and we think you see some of the companies that have shown up, some of the additional activity, supply contracts. But I do want to emphasize we had some new players in Cook Inlet, and I can tell you that you never want to jinx yourself, but we were very, very our supervisory regulatory role was a huge focus of our efforts over the summer, just because we wanted to make sure that it's done safely. And there certainly is a lot of activity, but we want the new players and even the old players to be exploring and producing in a safe manner that doesn't create any problems.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the next page is on critical elements, and I asked about that. But before you get off oil and gas, I wanted to ask, how aggressive have you been dealing with Doyon there? They're drilling an exploration efforts in the Nana Basin and the Yukon foothills.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, on Doyon issues, as a commissioner, I've recused myself on anything relating to Doyon just because my wife and daughters are shareholders. So maybe
Joe. Yeah, bring up that Fairbanks guy.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner to the Department of Natural Resources. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the folks at Doyon have been on a little bit of a slow burn since they spud the well in the Nana Basin. They obviously did not announce a discovery. What they learned from the well took them, I think, a little bit by surprise. They've been in contact with our resource professionals, both at the Division of Oil and Gas and the Division of Geologic Geophysical Survey, to explain what it is they think is there, what the potentials are. And to that end, they are pursuing seismic in the area again and intend to pull together capital to drill, I think, two more wells in the next couple of years. But in terms of any specific requests they've made of us, there aren't any that have come our way. We've just been an open door and made our technical expertise available to them.
Mr. Chief, thank you. There seems to be some critical elements that are on the table that various legislators are trying to extend, Cook Inlet tax breaks and things like that, and well credits. Have they talked about any infrastructure needs that the legislature could do? I mean, I'll just be right up front. Some of us wonder if a bridge over the Nana over there would, as a start, would open up a considerable amount of increased effort and other opportunities as well.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, certainly under the rubric of roads to resources, we have been considering at the DNR level what additional areas might make sense. Certainly the Nanana Basin an area contains a number of resources, not just oil and gas, that might prove attractive and worthy of merit in that program. But there's not anything like that in the FY13 budget request, something that probably will be a little bit further back on the burner.
Thank you.
So another, what we saw a positive aspect of 2011 was the increase in production with regard to minerals from the state. But really, in some ways, more important was that you saw the state becoming a focus of the country's exploration investment. So if you look at this, that number underneath the picture there, about one-third of all exploration investment in the United States last year, in 2010, actually, that's the latest number we had, took place in Alaska. And it's not just the big projects. If you look at that second to last bullet, 34 different projects spent over $1 million in 2010. And we think that that's promising, in particular because, as the members of this community know, these developments are very jobs intensive. I had the opportunity to actually get out to see Fort Knox over the course of last year. The numbers I think they mentioned to me, 800 jobs, average wage, $80,000, and those have enormous impacts on communities. So here's some of the different activity throughout the state. And then, Representative Guttenberg, to your question, we actually held what was called the Strategic and Critical Minerals Summit in Fairbanks at the end of September. It was very focused on rare earth elements. We had an enormous turnout. I actually didn't have a lot of time to even put it together, and it was a sold-out venue. We had to turn people away. We had investors from all over the country. We had the Japanese government show up. We had Reuters News, national stories, Bloomberg, and people who went through this said it was probably one of the most interesting, exciting because of the opportunity that people saw in the state. And probably more importantly, a lot of people from out of the state showed up in Fairbanks because they saw there was a lot of opportunity. So at that summit, the governor laid out our five-part strategy on strategic and critical minerals. And again, I can brief the committee on this at another time. But one of the things that's actually, what, there was a question from Representative Jewell a little bit ago is.
Yeah, Representative Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mining, we're pretty much at the infancy stage of any large mine developments, and I'm not talking real large, remember, I said. but just major ones. We've got our revenues that we're getting, which is now, not to inflate a fight, surpass fishing and unrestricted general fund revenues. Are we going to see it blowing way past? Have you been working with revenue on the projections of what we expect to see out of mining and providing?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, we look at the seven mines that are on state land or in the state right now. There are seven operating major mines. Keeping in mind that only two of those are actually on state land, and that's Pogo and Usabelli are the two that are on state land. Fort Knox is on Mental Health Trust land, so.
Which is an indirect route to the state.
Right. It is, Representative Stoltz. So. We have not made any plans to look at changes to the revenue structure for the mining projects at this time. I know there are some proposals in the legislature right now.
No, that's not my question. I'm not talking about increasing. We've got a problem with commissioners. We're not talking about raising taxes. We're talking about production, both in oil and in mining. We had the same problem with DEC. We're not talking about raising a tax. We want to increased production, both of oil and in mines. So we've kind of slipped into the tax part. I want to stay as far away from that as I can.
Apologies, Representative Stoltz, through the chair.
Through the chair.
We actually, things are looking pretty bright. And a good way to put it in perspective is that our permitting folks at DNR are incredibly busy right now. We have Donlin Creek, which is about ready to.
Donlin Gold.
Donlin Gold, which is about ready to submit permit applications. They're in the process of doing that right now. That will be, if permitted, that will be the largest gold mine by far, maybe close to double the size of Fort Knox. In addition to that, the gas line to it will probably be the largest construction project in Alaska since TAPS. The Livengood project up near Fairbanks is huge, and that's going full steam. There may be a couple of years out from starting permitting. Weir Pebble is a couple of years out from submitting any permit applications. The Nidlac project in southeast Alaska is a very promising project. We just got out of some meetings with Heatherdale Resources in Vancouver and got a project update. And there may be a year or two out from submitting permit applications, and that will be another Greens Creek-sized mine in southeast Alaska on Prince of Wales Island, which would be terrific for the economy of southeast. So a number of significant projects that are in the pipeline right now, and then there are a number of really significant exploration prospects, like the Pyramid Prospect out on the Alaska Peninsula, which is a large copper occurrence. It's a lot of activity in Alaska right now, a lot of interest. So I think, if things go well for the mining industry and for the state, and we can develop some of these projects responsibly, we'll have a significant increase in revenues from mining.
So Mr. Chairman, just continuing. So we had
a couple others. I'm just waiting if you had a follow up. Representative Garen and Jewell.
Mr. Fogles, just on the mining issue, and I think not including some of the recent applications, I think we have a very strong and responsible mining history in the state. But can you remind me, because there has been debate in this building about this, can you remind me what the royalty is for mining, and then of the major mines, you don't pay corporate tax unless you're a C corporation. Are those all C corporations, or do they avoid the corporate tax by? Do you not know?
They do not avoid the corporate tax, to my knowledge. The royalty is, I believe, 3% of net after the first 3 years, and then there's the corporate income tax, and then the mining license tax. I think the mining license tax is, I believe, 7.5%, and then a 9% corporate income tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Jewell, then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. First of all, I'd like to recognize Chuck Degnan, former member of the House at one point, from Unalakleet. I wanted to highlight him because I used to ride on his shoulders when I was a little kid in Unalakleet when my dad taught school out in St. Michael's. And so welcome. It's good to see you, Chuck. But the question I have is with regards to the Red Dog Mine and the 6.7 million ounces of silver in 2010, and wondering how that stacks up in terms of is anybody close to that in the state, and then how that stacks up nationally in terms of silver production.
Representative Jewell, through the chair. That may take it may take me a little bit to get back to you on the specific numbers, but Greens Creek is, as we say here, the fifth largest silver mine in the world, and it produced 7.2 million ounces of silver last year. So that kind of gives you a sense for where the Red Dog production lies, and we can get you some clear numbers on what the other mines are and where Red Dog really ranks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, the critical mineral stuff. You've got one, it looks like just one, Buchan Mountain. I'm not sure. I know there are others around the state. And I was at that conference, and it was amazing, and I expected to be bored, and I was just amazed every time I turn around and every speaker. And actually, one of the most significant things that anybody said was, one gentleman, one scientist who's been doing it for 50 years said he'd never been at a conference where there were anywhere near that many people. That was amazing.
No, we were blown away, Chair, Representative Guttenberg, just because the backstory is we only had, if you look at the agenda, we had a great agenda, right? We had governors, senators, generals, I mean, CEOs,
But we only had, because we were trying to get all these guys together, we only had 5 weeks to, from the time we said we're going to do it to the time we did. So 5 weeks to put together a summit like this is pretty short amount of time. And we were a little bit worried that, geez, 5 weeks, no one's going to show up. And it was, you know, as you saw, we had to literally turn people away. The fire marshal in Fairbanks said we had too many people in the building.
Well, one of the highlights, if I may, Mr. Chair, one of the highlights that came out of that for me was not the mining aspect of it, but what happens after it comes out of the ground. There's a huge process that goes on in it, much more so than I think almost any other element or any other mineral process. And you know, to right now, before we're knee deep in it, hopefully we will be knee deep in it at some point, is to build up and put in place a process where they come in and those processes stay in the state, where they're hiring people is equivalent to Fort Knox or any other gold mine, where it builds its own industry and hiring lots of people is also, I mean, it's best to do it now. Do it before it happens. Invite people, entice them in, because we've got it here. Because part of the things that we heard was China's got control of it, and they're not exporting anymore. But it's not that they have more. It's just that they're also expected to run out of it. So there is going to be a major gap in worldwide needs for I can't even begin to say all of the names of the rare earth elements. But let's get in the game early, and let's set up what's good for Alaska now. I think that's what we should be doing.
I would agree 100%, and I think coming out of that summit, there's a lot of enthusiasm. The other great thing about it, there's a lot of kind of, you know, on-the-side deal-making, and that's exactly the kind of stuff we wanted to have happen. The investors, the interested parties, we were having good discussions, particularly our ADA reps with the UCOR senior execs that were there. So that discussion, particularly as it related to processing, has begun.
Thank you.
So this was the strategy the governor announced at the summit. And then one element of not only that strategy, but also the Secure Alaska's Future strategy relating to increasing oil production, it involves permitting reform. And I just want to thank Representative Costello and others on the support that, well, the whole legislature, we had what we thought was very useful bipartisan support last year in terms of talking about what we were going to be doing. This is kind of the way we're looking at it now, but more to Representative Jewell's specific question. Since the last legislature, we think we've made, to be honest, I think we've made more progress than I was anticipating. I'll give a shout-out to our new Director of Mining, Land, and Water, Brent Goodrum, who's a retired Marine recon and infantry officer, literally got off active duty and took up this job and is really kind of taking the hill on all the work here. And so we've made significant progress in terms of filling all the vacancies that we were given the funding for. And one of the big things that we're going to ask for is to put that in the baseline budget. We've, if you look at one of the bullets there, looking at the revamping of our IT system, we've been reevaluating the entire process so we don't get to this backlog level again. And what I didn't think we'd be able to say first 6 months of FY12 is we reduced the backlog by 21% at the same time we've been. So that was that last July was about 2,600 permits. Now it's about 2,000. So we've made very good progress on that. And then maybe you've seen it. We've been getting out all over the state to public hearings that we've been holding to just get input from different stakeholders throughout the community to see what ideas they would have on making our permitting system more efficient, more timely, more certain. Not talking about cutting corners, but we are talking about making sure that it doesn't take, you know, a mine like Kensington 20 years to come online. So there's a lot of work going on, and we're likely to have a number of things that we'd be working with the legislature during this session on those issues.
Okay, Commissioner, I have a question. One of the issues that people have been bringing up, coastal zone management, and did that because coastal zone wasn't in place, did it stop? I mean, did it accelerate development permits or did it slow them down? I mean, what was the impact? And I know what DNR's position might be this year, but can you cover just the impacts of that was?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the most the biggest example of where the issue was probably going to be before us was the exploration season on the North Slope. So, as you know, when that slide that I showed a while back, you know, close to 20 exploration wells, that's a lot of work in terms of rigs, permits, water use, ice roads. So the division, not just DNR, but Fish and Game. And so what ended up happening, normally that would have gone through the coastal zone process. What we ended up doing was just working very, very closely with the North Slope Borough as we went through that. So the coordination effort was still there. We're working at ways to actually look at how to even do that better, but that was a real big surge of a ton of very important applications for the state, and we were able to work through that, I think, efficiently, particularly with the North Slope Borough that has an important role in that. And so that was an example of where the ACNP program would have kind of been the point, and we're still able, there's no permit that's not, that hasn't already been acted on by us or the borough that relates to the busy exploration season we have.
Okay, thank you.
So this is kind of the update on the permitting, and we can be glad to provide more details on that, but a lot of good progress. The other thing, in addition to oil, gas, minerals, you know, the obviously the department is focused in a number of other areas. These are some of the accomplishments that we saw as important in the agriculture sector. We are talking with OMB about expanding a horticulture program to fill what's a pretty significant hole in the USDARS closures, and we're going to get back to the legislature on that. You've had a lot of activity with regard to parks and outdoor recreation. I think that last bullet says the most about a program that's actually saving lives in the state, very important. And then, as was talked about earlier, the timber resources we see as building on in this session what we did in the last legislative session, which is to look at increasing the size of the state forest, and we think that's very important. For those in the interior, they know these pictures, and you see the size of the fires that we were up against last year. But in some ways, the good news is there was no big news on the wildfires because the teams did such a good job of fighting them.
I have a Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, if you go back to page 28, just a little disclaimer. I am one of those Pianese farmers, and I want to thank you very sincerely for just right up front talking about the huge hole that's left by the USDA loss of positions, not just for peony farmers, but for everybody across the state. You know, most states have state-supported infrastructure, and it's paid by industry, because we've been looking at this, who pays for it outside, you know, most ag states. But that's going to be a huge hole for everybody that's going on. And the last time I looked, there's a peony conference going on right now in Girdwood, and I would be there except my plane is 10 hours late. They're flying in apart from Anchorage. But I want to thank you that, because that is a growing industry in the state. And we all talk about food security. We all talk about school gardens and the farms to school programs. And, and there's farmers around the state that are looking to increase that into a cabinet-level position. I'm not sure we're at that level yet, but I think the focus statewide, and the co-chair was the Friend of Farmers, I think, the Year Award, and I we all should be concerned about it because, whatever's grown local is a whole lot better than shipped in from Uruguay or someplace else, but I just want to thank you for bringing that up right up front because that's very important.
Thank you. So,
I have a question from Representative Newman. I guess it's more of a comment in making sure that other members are aware of this. I had a discussion with Director Mace the other day. You know, the Federal Access Property to Volunteer Fire Department program was an important program that I worked on for years with the department. But now the state's in a position, because of the work that the state has done, the legislature, quite frankly, and through some ERA funds, of making sure that our state forestry is very well equipped with the equipment that they've got. They've retooled a lot of their equipment, and now have some federal or some state access firefighting equipment that's available to our volunteer fire department. So folks of us who represent a lot of the volunteer fire departments, just wanted to make note there, just a public note, you know, that some of the stuff's now going through forestry to make it available for the local volunteer fire departments. You know, if they have first response and get those fires stomped out before they turn into large forest fires, it helps all of us. And so whatever we can do to continue funding to make sure we pass that stuff through down to our volunteers is an important part of what we do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, and I think, you know, our teams did a great job tackling some very big fires. It just did not get out of control in the Fairbanks area in particular. You look at that picture, that's a huge fire there. One other thing we thought was somewhat, but it's always hard to tell, positive development, 2011. We did see some signs that the federal government was kind of throttling back. You know, I think in 2009 and 2010 was a very hostile view of resource development in Alaska, but it's a bit of a one step forward, two steps back. We finally made progress on the CD5 decision, but now we're starting to have some issues with the feds at Point Thompson, which, as everybody here knows, is state land. And we're trying to make sure that...
Hold the page. I think Representative Wilson has a question. Federal government hostility, she's there.
You know how it goes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked through your presentation, and I guess this is probably the best place to put it, but where do you see access at with the Mosquito Fork and the RS-2477s? I noticed that issue isn't in here, and it's a really big issue up in the interior. Where does that lay? I know we gave extra money last year in hopes that maybe we're getting a little bit closer, or maybe we can make the government less hostile. Either one works.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, and then I'll have Deputy Commissioner Fogles will give a little bit more detail. But we were very appreciative of the funding, and we've been using it. We've had teams out pretty much all summer doing the research. You know, the Attorney General last year indicated that we are indications that we would, you know, bring suit on a number of these. So we're moving forward quite aggressively on the RS-2477 issue. So the fact that it's not in here doesn't mean we don't see it as important. We've been quite focused on it.
I'll just make a 20-second comment. The previous Attorney General, what a great job he did just jumping into that 300 days away from home last year. I can see why he, what he did in securing the state's position on such a wide array of litigations, despite, you know, there were some cheap shot criticisms of that we were just gratuitously suing. I think you've outlined in your previous tenure in that office at how important it is, and it's nobody likes to hire lawyers and lawyer up, but I appreciate the continuity, and I hope our new Attorney General doesn't skip a step on that.
Now, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'll just add that as the Commissioner said, we've done a huge amount of field work this summer. We had teams out in the field and gathered tons and tons of data that's now being compiled. We'll have that available in some kind of report at some point here in the fairly near future. We now have an Assistant Attorney General that is specifically assigned to RS-2477 assertion. So he's going through all this, and he's helping us reevaluate our strategy. I think it's important an important event that happened is we've sort of formed a partnership with the state of Utah, which is another state that is facing these same issues, and we've had them come up to Anchorage. We've sent staff to Utah to look at how they are conducting their battles, and we've learned an awful lot from the state of Utah. And I believe we're getting ready to give you a much more detailed briefing on on that here a little bit later. So,
follow up, sir.
Representative Wilson.
Now, the navigability, just so people know, there are two separate issues. We have trails and we have rivers, and just so those who may not know, you have the Mosquito Fork up in the Chicken area. You can literally stand on the bridge on one side. The government says it's navigable. You just turn around. You're not moving much more than that. You know, and they say it's not. I mean, and that's just, you know, crazy that we're fighting over whether a river is navigable when you can absolutely see it. And we've got miners who are just getting ready to start renewing their own state claim that they've had there for many, many years. And I just want to make sure that we have the support there for them, especially in this important area. And so I do know that Chicken is not in my area, but the miners who are doing it are my constituents. So that for me, even over the trails, is a very important issue to keep on so that we don't lose sight that there's some real people there that spend 5-6 months in some really horrible conditions to be able to also, you know, have that hope of finding some type of minerals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This less hostile federal government, this is more of a state government thing, and it might be a little bit of federal in here. But I've been contacted by several miners in my district. One is operating in a small mom-and-pop gold mine just north of Fairbanks that they've done for 28 years, I believe he said. This last spring, he's received notice that he has to come into further compliance with safety and OSHA inspections. I mean, this is a small mom-and-pop thing where every time they get out of their vehicle, they have to chalk the tires on their truck, guards on their equipment, report to the state where their mine is, the number of days that they're mining. I mean, the amount of paperwork that he has to do now has just gone crazy. What happened this last year in their changes in regulation to where even just these small people have been doing this, and this guy's been a miner, and he's still got all 10 fingers, you know, but now he has to, you know, apply to all these state regs, the changes in regs. Is that a force from the federal down into the state, or is it something the state's doing?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the safety aspect of the whole mining sector is regulated by the Federal Mine Safety Health Administration, and the state really doesn't have any kind of counterpart or delegated responsibility for that. I do know that a number of years ago, there were, in the last several years, there were some pretty serious mining accidents, specifically in coal mines in the lower 48, and so the MSHA has sort of ramped up its regulatory oversight apparently fairly dramatically. So I think that's maybe part of the reason some of these small miners are sort of seeing increased regulatory oversight. But again, the state has a very limited role in the safety aspect of the mining process.
Recognizing the clock, if we got about 16 pages, a minute a page. Why don't we go through? Why don't we hold the questions, and we'll let you clip through it, and we'll come back with any questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'll go through these very quickly. So none of these significant challenges that we're talking about here are a surprise to anybody. But what we want to do is kind of highlight these, and then kind of tie them into the budget proposals that we have. So TAPS certainly is one. Commercializing North Slope gas, and we think we've made actually significant progress in that area, particularly with kind of the governor's shift with regard to LNG. Those are some of the key parameters that we see for a project, but also the governor laid out in the State of the State speech what he sees as a reasonable roadmap, and we're working very hard on that right now, I can tell you. And then, as always, and I think it's kind of been a theme of the discussion here, is the balance between responsible resource development and environmental stewardship, and it's something that we certainly work hard on every day, sometimes with big decisions, but it's part of the culture that we're trying to instill, and I think DNR has a good record of doing that. So I just wanted to touch very quickly on some of the FY13 highlights in terms of the budget. This was a seven-year look back that came from the Ledge Finance, and a couple trends there in terms of average growth, about 5.7%, and you'll see that actually over the last 5 or 6 years, DNR has been a decreasing percentage of the state GF, and there's a number of reasons for that. That's kind of the core services and where we break out in terms of our FY13 budget requests, and we think that that's about the right mix in terms of our four core services. Similarly, related to that, that gives you a sense of what each division piece of the budget pie is for the FY13 budget. A bit of a busy slide, but just gives you a sense of that. And then this is kind of, in terms of core services, a slide that depicts the difference between the FY12 management plan and the governor's FY13 request. The overall increase, it looks rather large, $11.6 million, but of that, $6.5 million is increased federal receipts to support fire suppression activity, and $2.2 million in industry-supported fees for the OPRM office. So the unrestricted GF increase would be about $2.3 million. And then this just gives a very quick snapshot of some of the most high-priority areas that we have in terms of subject matter. You see the TAPS issue, strategic minerals, gas line, permitting, and then ag and parks, and what is in the governor's FY13 budget that are important requests that we have both from the operating side and then from the capital budget side. So that just gives kind of a overview of the different areas that we're requesting in the budget that we think continue to support some of the key priorities and as I mentioned at the outset, build on what we saw as a promising 2011. So that's the wrap up, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate your time. I know we went a little long, so we'd be glad to take any additional questions.
You gotta look up fast we go if we don't muddy up the process. Representative Guerra.
Commissioner, we've always heard about the short drilling season in the winter in some areas on the North Slope, and it has to do with warming winters. And what are things that we can do to extend the drilling season on the North Slope? Are there feasible things we can do?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, it's a great question, because one of the things that certainly I've learned, and I'm still learning a ton in this job, but when you talk to companies, and I mentioned kind of the high costs, there's certain high costs of the oil or gas business in Alaska, particularly on the North Slope. Some are always going to be there. The remoteness, extreme Arctic weather, logistics issues. But that one comes up all the time. And, you know, when we look at even plans of operation, right now in terms of exploration, you typically have, it's not like in Texas or North Dakota where you're exploring year-round. Here it's about 4 months, and it's costly. So we've looked at ways to extend that. I think, you know, one thing we're doing with Great Bear Petroleum, you know, they're looking at the shale play, is they've chosen initial exploration wells right along essentially the Hall Road, where there has been previous activity. So they're going to be able to explore beyond just the normal exploration, kind of winter exploration season. The other thing that we think is important is to be able to actually have roads as two areas that are highly prospective, such as the road to Umia, that would help with year-round exploration. So it is an issue. We think, you know, the ice roads serve an important function with regard to minimal impact in the areas, sensitive areas on the North Slope. But looking at ways to extend that exploration season, I think, is a really important issue, because it will help bring down the costs, which are significant.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I mean, there is a certain amount of roads that we can build, right? But at some point, there's an economic incentive for companies to build roads, too. Is there a way to streamline and make easier the permitting process for a company to build a road to a prospect that might help?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, certainly something that we're looking to. The answer, we hope, is yes. You know, some of this is a mix of state and federal related issues with regard to EISs and 404C permits that deal with, you know, the Clean Water Act. But if we think we can do it in a way that's not cutting corners and still focused on, you know, being good stewards of the environment, we we're looking to do that. We're undergoing an enormous kind of look at regs, statutes statewide to try and get more efficiencies to bring on projects in a way that doesn't take 6 or 7 or 8 years.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I'd like to thank your folks that stayed online. We didn't have any questions for them, Mr. Parsons and Mr. Winifie, and hope things are good out in Kinnick River, Mr. Menifee. We have tomorrow, no, it's not tomorrow, there will be no meeting. Saturday, there will be training over the Terry Miller Gym. That's following up. We had an access issue here in Juneau last week, a rare occurrence, and this will take place 9 a.m. in the gym. I think Pete's making pedophores and treats, right? Okay. That'll be Mr. Holt. Okay. And then on Monday, we have the Department of Fish and Game and Commerce and Economic Development and House Bill 282, Military Training Credit, Temporary License that's pending referral. Anything else before the committee? We will stand adjourned.
Thank you.